KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
But we are going to insist on changes at Hanford. We are going to insist on a program that will remove the radioactive material from the leaking tanks and find a solution as quickly as humanly possible.
Letting yourself be drawn to a book by the title, or if it's face out, you know, the cover looks so interesting, or just, oh, I've heard about that author, let me try it. I'm one of those people who believes that reading is one of those things that make us a better person, because it expands our world.
Can expand your world with Nancy Pearl. She's our guest later this hour. We heard Governor Jay Inslee talking about the leaking waste storage tanks at Hanford. It's just one of the subjects we'll touch on just ahead. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher. State lawmakers are midway through the legislative session. How will last week's high court decision that nullifies the supermajority for tax increases affect what comes out of Olympia this year? Joining us to talk about that and more is Jerry Kornfield. He covers Olympia for the Everett Herald. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And I guess I want to pretend you're a mood ring for an instance. What is the mood following last week's Supreme Court ruling?
You know, I haven't walked around the building, but I know it's going to be good because, as you noted, it is a blue sky. So anytime there's sunshine around this place, they're happy. You know, it's a slow week. And it's a slow start to the week because they're going to spend most of the time debating bills on the floor of the House and Senate. So there probably won't be a lot of attention paid to, you know, the two-thirds ruling in a public way. Behind closed doors, I think they're wrestling with, you know, in the House, the Democrats are wrestling with, you know, what do we want to put on the table later this month when we write our budget? And the Republicans in the Senate are wrestling with, we know something's coming, so what do we do with our budget to sort of thwart that attempt to raise taxes?
Now, I know that we passed about a week and a half ago, maybe a little less, the cutoff date for bills to be introduced. Where are we at now with what is in play and what's not in play?
Well, there's sort of three deadlines that the lawmakers work on. The first cutoff deadline they hit was on those bills that really have no money attached. They're just policy. So the controversial social issue bills and other changes in policy, that's come and gone, and many have gone forward, and that's what they're voting on this week. On Friday, they dealt with all those budget-related bills, the pieces, if you will, of the budget puzzle. They were both in the Senate and House passing them out of their budget committees. So those are also on tap to be worked on. And then, of course, you know, what they say around here is nothing's dead until the session's over. So theoretically, anything could be brought up on the floor between now and the 105th day. But we are now getting to the point where all they want to talk about is what costs money and what changes do we want to make, big or small, in the way this government affects people.
We're talking with Jerry Kornfield of the Everett Herald about the week ahead in Olympia. The charter school law took effect. The Washington Charter School Commission is to be named. Earlier last week, opponents filed a lawsuit that challenges that law. So where are we at with charter schools in this state?
Well, again, we have multiple pathways, if you will, people are walking on right now. Let's go with what's going to happen this week first. There is in that law a new commission that is created, and a nine-member Washington State Charter School Commission. They're the ones who will be authorizing some of these early charter schools in the next couple of years. There's nine members. We'll find out who those nine are, the appointees. Wednesday's the deadline to make them public, so between now and Wednesday we should learn those. Meanwhile, on the legal front, the opponents had said for a long time they thought this measure was unconstitutional, but lack of money or lack of energy, they didn't file anything. Now they have. They've asked the Attorney General to do something. He won't. He publicly said, I'm going to defend the voters' right to approve this law. So now they have to decide. Are they going to go to court and try to, you know, preempt it from taking effect? We'll find that out, I guess, in the next 30 days.
And how does this impact, if at all, last year's ruling that the state needs to fully fund K-12 education?
Well, they're going to try to make a connection, but I don't think they're going to succeed in court. The charter schools are publicly funded and privately run. And so what I expect to happen is they'll have a battle in court. At the same time, the process for creating and setting up these charter schools will go forward. And a totally different conversation will be about money for schools. That's all in the budget. And no one's quite sure what the lawmakers will try to do or even be able to do this year. Later this month, two things are going to happen. First, on March 20th, there will be a report of a forecast of how much money they expect to get in the next 2 years, mm-hmm. the next 4 years. These forecasts are what they write their budgets on. So several days after that, we'll get a budget, and we'll find out if either the House or the Senate can come up with any money to fully fund education this in the near future.
We heard at the beginning of this hour, Jerry, a little clip from Governor Jay Inslee talking about how we're going to hold the feds, their feet to the fire, to fully clean up Hanford. The governor goes to the Tri-Cities later this week to tour what's happened.
Yeah, he's going on Wednesday. He may have to hold their feet right to the edge of the nuclear waste itself. This has been a problem that's been going on for
right.
a while. And he takes office, and I think when he took office, the message was there is no problem. And then the first report was, well, we found a little leak, or as the feds like to say, the levels were declining, and they shouldn't have been declining. And now they say there's like six tanks. And so he's going to go, and he's had meetings with Secretary of Energy Chu in Washington, D.C. He's been assured there's no threat to the public health, but it's still a problem. And now there's a real concern that with the federal cuts that are coming, there might be a decline and a drop-off in funding for the cleanup. So he's worried about that. So he's going to take a tour, see for himself. I don't know what you can see.
It's right.
He can't get too close. He can't wade through the leaky stuff, but he can look at it. And I think he just wants to dramatize the issue and say, hey, look, this is happening here in Washington. You folks in the other Washington not only need to pay to clean it up, but you need to find a solution like Yucca Mountain in Nevada. Get that designed and fixed and opened and go forward, because we need a place for this stuff.
We were talking with our Richland correspondent, Anna King, last week, and she was saying one big issue right now with these at least six leaking tanks, seven figured out how many more might be leaking, is that they were going to build another tank, but that's not done to move all this to. So theoretically, they have to fix the ones that are in the ground. And Yucca Mountain is a pipe dream way off in the future.
Yeah, it's if it even happens. This is one of those problems where it's 2013 and there's nothing on the board. There's no technology known that will take care of these things, these leaks. And even if they even contain the leak, they still have the waste, and they're not really sure. They have ideas of how to deal with the waste, but it's really, really expensive to take care of and to get rid of. And this is going to be a problem through many generations into the future, no matter what happens in the next few weeks.
This morning in the other Washington, as you referred to it, and as we often refer to it, President Obama...
Confused. Don't they all sound alike sometimes?
President Obama named three more cabinet members, and one of them was Gina McCarthy. He named to head the EPA. This was a job that yet again slipped through Governor Chris Gregoire's fingers?
Yeah, I think, I guess it depends on how we look at it. Out here, we figured former Governor Chris Gregoire was just a shoo-in for some seat at the table of the Obama administration, and he's been filling all these seats without her. So I think her options are dwindling. I mean, the EPA was a spot. Secretary of Energy, her name was rumored to be under consideration. Secretary of Interior mm-hmm. was another job. That went to another different woman in Washington, Sally Jewell of REI. As far as I can tell, the options that are on the table that would be that high level are the Secretary of Labor, Hilda Solis, she's leaving. The Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, he's leaving. They're retiring. Those two spots have not been filled. Secretary of Commerce, which of another former governor,
right.
Gary Locke, he held the job for a while. That's, there's an acting person in that position, and then the U.S. Trade Representative. And maybe they want to send her around the world to sell Boeing planes. But otherwise, She might be looking at something she said she didn't want to do, retire. They retired.
Is there some reason that she expects to get a job in the Obama administration?
Well, I think the expectations were on those, myself and others, that are the pundits, the politicos, mm-hmm. the folks who look around and say, who does the governor put in his cabinet? Who are his high-level advisors for his second term? And you look and you say, oh, a governor from a Washington state, a Democrat who supported him, who's done, you know, been on the national stage in various areas of her career, like the tobacco lawsuit, seemed like a shoe-in. You know, you'd want somebody like that. But it turns out that he's found other very talented women, and maybe he doesn't feel like he wants to take another person from Washington State. It's there is some talent in the country. He gets to have his picks. But I don't know that she was never saying, hey, I want this job. I hope I get it. She was always downplaying the possibilities of ending up in the Obama administration just for this reason. The expectations wouldn't be high, and we wouldn't all say, oh, she didn't make it.
Yeah, I wonder now.
Do that anyway.
Exactly, Jerry.
Some firm in Seattle will offer her a gig.
I'm guessing that you know, Gary Locke got a gig like that right out of his office, so I'm sure she is too. On a less or slightly less political note, and we'll end with this. Over the weekend, we celebrated the 160th anniversary of the creation of Washington Territory.
I didn't see the cake with all the candles. I was wondering who they'd bring to blow it out. But that's pretty interesting, too, that in the Secretary of State's office has a map. If people want to go on their website, that actually could see the map of what the territory looked like. And I believe they have a link to all of different organizations, most of which were churches that were established during the territorial days of Washington and are still in existence today. And it's really amazing how many organizations were created, fraternal organizations, et cetera, and they're still around today.
Well, 160 years compared to some places, not that long a time.
Yeah, not at all. I'm looking around. What's a 160-year-old building in Washington versus, let's say, we'll go to Europe and we'll find
exactly.
one about 1,600 years. Well, we need a castle. That's what they should do. Build a castle in, say, Olympia.
And
we'll think it's 160 years old.
That's going to push me and pull me pretty hard there. Jerry Kornfield covers Olympia for the Everett Herald. Looking ahead to the week in the state capitol, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
Book recommendations from Nancy Pearl in a minute here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from All-Wheel Drive Auto, independent Subaru repair and maintenance on the east side, specializing in head gasket repair. More information about all offerings is online at allwheeldriveauto.com, helping drivers get more from their Subarus.
41 degrees in Seattle under a mostly clear sky. Expect sun today with an afternoon high of 54. 10:18, I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's election day in Kenya. There's been long lines and violence as people wait to cast their votes. We'll have an update on Kenya's election in the news at 11 o'clock.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher's on vacation. Many years ago, Nancy Pearl came to KUOW to recommend a book called Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. It was a British publication by a woman named J.K. Rowling, and this book Nancy went nuts over. I don't know if you remember that, but I was talking to you might know what happened to that book. When it came to the United States, it was called Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. It was the first of seven books aimed at young readers, a lot of books aimed at a certain teenage demographic, and they do appeal to those of us who are slightly older than 16. Nancy Pearl is here once again, going to talk about some of those books with us. Nancy, if you somehow don't know who she is. Librarian extraordinaire, author of the Book Less series, a regular book commentator on KUOW and NPR's Morning Edition. Nancy, do you remember coming and telling me about some wild book that you read that you got and imported and you were just nuts about that book?
Yeah, and I still hear from people who say, boy, that you were the first person that I heard about Harry Potter from.
Yeah, because I think you were the first American who read it.
Well, at least here.
The first Maybe. Person in Seattle. So we're we're here today to talk about books that weren't necessarily written with adults in mind, but that we might like. And we, as always, we shout out to you listeners to contribute 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW, or 1-800-289-5869. Okay, so I think everybody knows why Harry Potter is a good read. Yeah.
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. But I would say... another really good read, which I also talked about years ago when it came out, is by Suzanne Collins. And this was long before she became so well known for The Hunger Games. But she wrote a series that began with Gregor the Overlander.
I remember that.
And it's about a boy, a very brave boy named Gregor, who is searching for his father in the Underland. And he's faced with not only the kind of tropish difficulties that we find in fantasy, but he's faced with really interesting moral dilemmas and who you trust. And I would say if your 10-year-old, your 11-year-old, even 9-year-old has not read Gregor the Overlander, that's one I would definitely get them.
Well, let me, I'm hearing a weird echo, so I'm asking people to fix it. I think there's one extra microphone on someplace. But let me, when we're talking about adults reading these books for teenagers, what qualities do these books need to have that they transcend the audience that they might have been intended for?
Well, in some ways, I think that all of the that a lot of it is going back to the publishing industry and who the marketing department is aiming books for. Mm. I'm certainly finding a number of books that are marketed to teens but could just as easily be marketed to adult readers. And I'm not sure if the teen market is small enough so that they would have a better chance of breaking out in that, whereas the adult market is kind of saturated.
So is it that the marketing people sit around at a table and say, well, this is a really great book, but if we position it this way, it's going to sell more copies?
I don't know for sure, but but I would not be surprised if that weren't the case. And I think what those books have in common, those certain teen novels and those adult books, are a complexity of plot. I think they have characters who are three-dimensional, who engage you in some way. But just because a character is a teenager within those years, 12 to 18 or 12 to 20, doesn't mean that the book is a teen novel or exclusively a teen novel. And I think that readers looking for wonderful reads, books that will give them a lot of pleasure, a lot of the kind of feeling you have when you meet up with characters that then stay around in your life for a long time, long after you finish the book, that teen novels are a really good place to go.
We're talking with Nancy Pearl. 1-800-289-5869 is our number. We're talking about teen novels only because that's what they're called. So we're talking about good books that might be enjoyed by a big demographic. I watched the movie this weekend, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, which I think was a teen novel, correct?
Yes.
But went beyond teendom.
Right. Yes. And why did it go beyond teendom?
Why did it?
Marcy?
It was a good story with compelling characters.
It was a good story with compelling characters, and it had more going for it than nostalgia, I think. When you look at now, one of my favorite teen novels of all time is Beverly Cleary's 15, and I could quote parts of that book to you. I mean, I those characters are so real to me. But when I reread it, which you can't do very often, I find, because it isn't complex enough.
Yeah.
To me, that's a teen novel. That's not going to appeal to a lot of adults, except for those adults who grew up, were the same age as Jane was, perhaps, the heroine of the book. And you compare that, I think, to John Green's The Fault in Their Stars, The Fault in Our Stars, which I think is a book that that the three main characters are teenagers, and yet it's a book that is so well plotted. The arc is so nicely handled. Goodness knows the ending is enough of a surprise to please anybody. And that's a book definitely not just for teens.
Is there conversely books with teenage protagonists that are not for teens, or maybe not for some teens?
Yes, I think there are, and I would be interested to hear what books those are.
I'm sorry, I threw you that.
No, Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird has a much younger heroine than, you know, Scout Finch is not a teen. Is that a book for teens? Well, it's been taken over by teens because it's a high school assignment in many places. But she didn't write that for teens. Mal Peet, there's an author named Mal Peet, and his newest book is called Life, an Exploding Diagram. Hmm. And the main characters are teens. I have not met a teen who has read that book. And I think that, and it's set between World War II and 9/11, 2001. And the subject matter of that book, and the relationship between the two main characters, I think it's an adult novel, but it's you'll find it in the teen section of the library or the bookstore.
You mentioned Suzanne Collins, Gregor the Underland.
Overland. Right.
What about The Hunger Games? Do those transcend for you?
Yes, I think they do. And in fact, I think is a book about kids killing kids.
For teens?
For teens.
Maybe not.
Maybe not.
We want to know what you think. We're talking about a broad topic.
It's yes.
Whether certain teen novels transcend the audience that they may or may not have been intended for, depending on who the marketing person was. And if you've got recommendations or questions, this is the time to talk to Nancy Pearl here on Weekday. She comes to us once a month, 1-800-289-5869. Or you can email us, weekday@kuow.org. Hi, Nikki in North Seattle. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have probably a little bit of a different take than you're expecting from some of your listeners. I have to say I'm continually stunned at not only the marketing of young adult novels to adults, but the seeming, voraciousness of people in their 40s and 50s to be reading these novels. When I was a teenager, when I was 13 years old and 14 years old, I was reading Dickens. I was reading Orwell. You mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird. I read that when I was 13. When I was 14, I read Johnny Got His Gun. And while these books may have been a little bit far beyond where you would expect someone my age to be reading, the fact is that I and all of my friends and my brother and sister were reading adult novels when we were teenagers. And I have to say, I just think it's kind of stunning the way it's kind of done a backflip, and I wonder what this really says about our culture.
Hmm. Well, that's an interesting question, Nikki. Are we dumbing down, or is it? I like to dip my nose into all sorts of books, and I don't necessarily think I am dumber. But it is true, and Nikki, you really pointed it out, that sometimes I don't want to work as hard as a more complex piece of literature, quote unquote, would make me work.
And I think there is that sense of books for teens are less, they're going to be less complex. They're going to be primarily plot driven. So they're going to be much easier to read, to pick up and put down. And also to think about is that this whole notion of a group of books for teen readers, how did that come about?
How did that come about?
I don't know.
Oh, maybe somebody does know. There are a lot of people who have books that they want to recommend.
Yes,
so like me, they're happy to admit that they're dumb or whatever I am. Neil Gaiman, perfect example of an author that writes for young adults, but many adults read his stories. says Leslie. With Emerald City Comic Con over the past weekend, I have graphic novels in mind. How do you feel about the medium? I know you like the medium.
I do like the medium quite a bit, and there's just some very interesting artists who are doing, artists and writers who are doing just fabulous graphic novels. Getting my hobby horse, just to call them graphic novels is to misstate what they are. Some of the best ones are not novels at all. To say graphic brings up for many people, a certain sense of the kind of book that it is. We talk about graphic violence, graphic sex, graphic novels.
What do you call them?
I think we should call them comics, for goodness sake.
Okay. our producer, Amina, emailed from the other room and said she loved Philip Pullman's trilogy, the Golden Compass trilogy. I loved, in caps, I love them when I first read them as a young teen. I think they're engaging enough for adults, and I'd like to reread them and see if they are good beyond nostalgia.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, they came out pretty contemporaneously with the Suzanne Collins Hunger Games. And one of the differences is, I think, that Philip Pullman is writing for an older audience. And the first book is, yes, pretty much aimed at that older teen. But the other books get far more complex in the Golden Compass trilogy.
I'm just thinking about this because yesterday I was watching a DVD that had a lot of trailers, and one of them was for The Hobbit, a book that was, I think, written for young kids, right?
Was
the Lord of the Rings trilogy meant for teenagers?
Well, it was meant for when J.R.R. Tolkien's kids grew up. I mean, he wrote The Hobbit for when they were little kids, and when they grew up, then there was The Lord of the Rings waiting for them.
But there are a lot of levels in books like that. I mean, you could also, the Chronicles of Narnia, those guys, those Oxford Dons or Cambridge
right.
Dons or whichever kind of Dons they were they had a lot of layers of meaning that they wanted to address within a story format.
They did, and J.K. Rowling did the same thing.
So did Philip Pullman.
Absolutely Philip Pullman did. And Philip Pullman, probably even more than J.K. Rowling, harked back, I think, to the Inklings period of Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and Charles Williams and those big names. But when kids get out of books what they're ready to get out of books, and I think it's a shame when an 8-year-old starts with the Harry Potter books and reads the whole series. Why do I think it's a shame? Not because they're going to learn something that you shouldn't know at 8 years old, but because that series is spoiled for them because they've read it. And there are things in the 6th and 7th book that an 8-year-old just isn't going to get. And why? I mean, if I had my druthers, I would have kids read those books in exactly the same time range that they were published.
Nancy Pearl is with us, and we want to know what you think. We're talking about teen novels, for lack of another term for it, because I think that's not exactly
right.
What we're talking
right.
about. 1-800-289-5869 is a toll-free number wherever you're listening. Hi, Karen in Bellingham. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Hi there. I was actually going to recommend Philip Pullman's his Dark Materials trilogy, but I heard you guys talking about that. But I had a question about adults who read teen novels, actually.
Go ahead.
Do you think there's something that characterizes an adult who really enjoys teen fiction? I haven't found a lot of people like myself, I'm 41, that just avidly read teen fiction, as well as other things. But
right.
I'm just wondering what you guys thought about that.
I think it's great. I think you should read whatever makes you happy.
I think you should read. You're going to say you think she should read.
Oh, yeah.
Period.
I think you should read, period. But I especially think you should read whatever makes you happy. And if reading teen fiction, you could do far worse than a diet of teen fiction.
Okay, so you're absolved, Karen in Bellingham. Thanks for joining us. We go now to Whidbey Island, where Dan's been holding. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I wanted to recommend Patricia Reed's The 13th Child. It's kind of a historical fiction, magical realism book that I thoroughly enjoyed.
What did you enjoy about it?
I think primarily the complexity and the family dynamics that it explores were really interesting to me. The main character is a child who is the 13th in her family and so is considered highly unlucky.
Oh, interesting.
And has a twin brother who is the 7th son and considered extremely lucky. And so it's kind of a story of her discovering her power.
And it's Patricia Reed, W-R-E-D-E.
And I've heard that pronounced Patricia Reedy, although I'm not convinced. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's one way or another. But Patricia Reedy is a writer whose fantasies, she's just one of those writers who all of her books are great to pick up and try, see if you like them. She wrote a wonderful series with the subtitle The Enchanted Chocolate Pot, Sorcery and Cecilia, which she wrote with another teen novelist, a novelist writer who writes for teen books. So, yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for that recommendation. That's The 13th Child by Patricia W-R-E-D-E. I'm just going
to
spell
it. Always better to spell.
Julia in Bellevue says, I've always appreciated Polly Horvath's books, especially Everything on a Waffle and The Canning Season.
Oh my gosh, those are so wonderful. And you kind of think, what child is going to, they're for 11 and 12 year olds, 13 year olds, and what child is going to appreciate those as much as an adult reader is?
Interesting. Cynthia and Ballard emailed in A Monster Calls by Patrick Ness. Do you know all these books, Nancy?
Some I know by calling up the picture of the on the cover.
Anne on Whidbey Island says her neighbor, Elizabeth George, a noted mystery novelist, has moved into young adult with her new novel, The Edge of Nowhere. I bought it for a teen, read it myself, liked it a lot. I'm a huge fan of George's long run. I don't even know how many books are in the series, the Thomas Linley series. Have you read The Edge of Nowhere?
No, I have not.
But aimed at young adults.
And that's another trend that we're seeing is adult novelists moving into writing for younger readers. Peter and the Starcatcher, for example, is written by two adult novelists. Carl Hiaasen has written for children, for kids. And it would be really interesting to talk to them about why, what it is that they're missing in their writing or what it is they're looking for in their writing experience to cause them to want to do that.
Sherman Alexie's...
Absolutely True Diary.
Of a part-time Indian.
Right.
I thought it was a great book. But I'm not sure if it was aimed at teenagers specifically.
Well, when I used it in Bosnia for book discussions, it covered all ages, and was a very powerful read.
Nancy Pearl is with us, and we're taking questions and suggestions and comments about books theoretically aimed at young adults or teens that would please a wider audience. Our phone number, 1-800-289-5869 or 206-543-5869, or as many of you have done, you can email us weekday at kuow.org.
@10:39, we'll get more book recommendations from Nancy and from you in a minute. By the way, there's a treasure trove of book recommendations on our website, like recommendations for self-help books, best books of 2012, and books to pass along to friends and family. All that and more at kuow.org. Just search for books.
Pat Summitt knows how to coach a winning team better than anyone else in college basketball.
You can challenge people, but you don't want to break people down. But you've got to sometimes just say, you're okay, but you can be better.
I'm Renee Montaigne, longtime coach Pat Summitt on Winning Games and now Fighting Alzheimer's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Foster Pepper, providing patent, trademark, copyright, and IP litigation legal services for small regional companies to Fortune 100 corporations. Online at foster.com and on Twitter. When it happens, Foster Pepper is there.
43 degrees and mostly sunny in Seattle. Expect sun all day with an afternoon high of 54. Clouds coming in overnight, though, with a chance of rain and a low of 37. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1040. A look at what might go into the choice of the next pope in 30 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher. And once a month, Nancy Pearl comes in to talk about books with us, and that's a very general topic, so we try to break it up into something manageable, and Nancy's here talking about books that are maybe aimed at a younger audience that are appealing to older readers as well, and we've got listeners online and people emailing in, and so we're just going to try to get to as many of you as possible. And Mac in South Seattle, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I find the topic very interesting since I'm a film student. And coming from England, our culture on books and reading and so forth is a whole lot different than when it comes to people here in the U.S., one of the suggestions I was talking about was concerning when you brought up the book *To Kill a Mockingbird*, which is a perfect example. Another perfect example is *Huck Finn* by Mark Twain. I mean, and his the other book that came from that also dealing with the two friends. I mean, yes, the characters were young, and some of their adventures dealt with things at that age level. But the climate, but the environment that they are living in is very adult oriented. And so, a lot of people, when they think of those books, they even put them have a misconception of putting them on that level of. That's a kid's book.
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah. Interesting comment. Yes, those books do have young protagonists, and they're not meant specifically for young audiences.
But... And another book, Marcy and I were talking at the break, is Betty Smith's A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, which is not for young people at all.
No.
Although many of us, I mean, I read it when I was 12, I think, and finally able to leave the children's room of the library and move to the adult section.
Very exciting. Thanks, Mac, for calling in. Pam says, I read a fair number of teen novels because they often explore fascinating themes, especially sci-fi and apocalyptic topics that highlight individual and societal challenges and choices, and they cut to the chase in ways that more serious novels often don't. A couple of great ones I've read lately are Life as We Knew It by Susan Beth Pfeffer, two sequels not as strong as the original, and Karen Thompson Walker's book The Age of Miracles.
Right. And now Age of Miracles was marketed to adults.
Oh.
So that's an interesting, it absolutely fits into that dystopian world view that we're getting so many of those books coming out about. I think that cutting to the chase, a book that I think fits into that really nicely is Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card, which children read a very different version of that book than adults do.
Interesting.
And it's something that I think would be a great family discussion.
Wow. So when we have those intergenerational book clubs.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
George wants to know if you consider Romeo and Juliet a teen novella. It was about young teenagers.
It was. But gosh, Shakespeare, he addressed that to adult audiences, I think.
Yeah. Interesting question, though. Hi, Katie in West Seattle. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to mention a nonfiction book called Go Ask Alice. And it was written, published, I think, in the early 70s. A friend of my mother's gave it to me when I was about 12. And sort of as a cautionary tale, but it's I was completely captivated. It's a actual diary of a teen girl starting at about age 15. And she continued to write in her diary as she descended into drugs and, you know, running away from home and all that sort of thing. And it was just, for me as a teenager, it was completely captivating, and it was a cautionary tale.
But it's not fiction, or it is fiction?
It's nonfiction. And interestingly enough, I saw it recently being promoted again at Barnes & Noble, but it was published in the early 70s.
Yeah, originally published in 1971, and published at that time by Anonymous.
And our producer, Andy, is shaking his head because he thinks it is fiction.
I think there's still some. It's purported to be the story of a woman whose last name is Sparks, I think. But when I read it, it was fiction.
Okay.
It was considered fiction. I'm not sure where libraries are keeping it these
days. But it fits into that category of an age-spanning book. Harry says, my son, who just turned 11, has been digging into young adult novels. I'm not sure how many would appeal to adults. He's read Libba Bray's Going Bovine, Cory Doctorow's Little Brother, and Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. One thing he really loves, his son, is a book that's funny. Sadly, funny books don't get as much respect from older audiences. I like funny books.
They're hard to find, and humor is such an iffy kind of notion to select a book on the basis of, because what's funny to one person is not so funny often to another. But those three books, Ready Player One, Cory Doctorow's Little Brother, and Libba Bray's Going Bovine, those are terrific reads.
They fit into your category.
They fit into my category of, I'm not sure, teens love them, but they translate very, very, very well for adult readers as well.
Harry, I don't know if you've read those books that your son is reading, so you're saying he should check them out.
Absolutely.
Check them out. Walt wants to know if you're familiar with Wildwood by Colin Malloy.
Yes, and there's a sequel to it out now.
He thinks it's a fine book, but he may be a better author than singer Colin Malloy is with the Decemberists in Portland. I don't know if you want to make any kind of judgment on his singing.
No, but doesn't he write some of the lyrics for the Decemberists too?
Yes,
that's what I thought. No, but I think that when we talk about contemporary fantasy for that age group, Colin Malloy's Wildwood is one of those very, very good ones.
Okay, Malloy, M-E-L-L-Y. We go next to Ballard, where Jeff's been holding for a little while. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to recommend Kim and Captain's Courageous by Kipling. Mm-hmm. They were two of my favorite novels as a young adult, well, aside from all the Tolkien books.
Have you read them again since then?
Yes, I have, both a couple of times. I was fortunate enough to actually have a roommate in college who was from India, and he swore that he could smell India when he read Kim.
Kim is one of my all-time favorite books, so I applaud people who are reading that. But that is a book that, again, a child who reads it, a 10, 11-year-old who reads it, is going— at this time, in this world that we're now living in, this stage of our development and world development, is going to read a far different book than somebody, say, who is familiar with colonialism and post-colonialism and the British in India. And it's a rollicking, good story mm-hmm. that kids will love that bears rereading the older you get.
Thanks for that suggestion, Jeff. In Ballard, we go to Redmond now. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Bill Vaughn. I'm the author of a series of books that begins with The Owl Wrangler, and they're published, I'm an independent publisher, one of those new ebook people, and the books are all five-star rated, but it's tough to get them into libraries and get them read by more people. The books are basically political commentaries. They talk about today's issues, but in a kid's story, I'm not going to call kids, but a young adult story way. So how do we, as independent authors, get into the libraries and get them in the hands of readers?
I always say that the best way to get a book purchased for the library market is to get a review in Publishers Weekly or Booklist or Library Journal, the magazine The Forward, which comes out of Grand Rapids, Traverse City, Michigan, does a lot of independent reviews, a lot of independently published books. So those are the things where I would go. Otherwise, it's very, very hard.
Thanks for that question, Bill. Robert, a firefighter in Bellingham, writes in, it's not that children's books are easy to read. I think it denigrates writers who've chosen kids as their audience to say they're easier. Young adult fiction is wild with fine writers who tell fascinating stories, from Kirby Larson's Hattie Big Sky and The Fences Between Us to John Green's The Fault in Our Stars and Rick Yancey's The Monstrumologist and Gary D. Schmidt's The Wednesday Wars.
Yes. Oh, gosh. And Rick Yancey has a brand new book coming out called The Fifth Wave, which is really good.
Okay.
For people who like thrillers, whatever age.
Okay, that's
the
me.
The Fifth Wave is just okay. a ton of great, good writing, great interest.
Okay. Thank you for sending that email. Tara's in Wedgwood, I think. Wedgwood? Tara?
Edgewood.
Okay. Hi, yeah. You're on the air.
Hi. One of the books that I really enjoyed, actually a whole author that I enjoyed when I was little, was Natalie Babbitt. It really kind of introduced me into the continuous reading that I continue on even today. Kind of a bookworm. I always have a book that I'm reading. And the other is Charles DeLintz. And I have read every book he's ever put out, short stories. And he really does cross over to the kids as well as the adult reader. Some of my favorites are anthologies of short stories he's created. The Onion Girl specifically is about a young adult. So it seems to really cross over.
So what is it, Tara, about these books that appeal to you?
Well, the Charles DeLintz books have a tendency to make it feel like you're in just everyday world, but tends to go a little bit over to the fantasy side, but it makes it seem almost possible. And especially when all these characters in these different books are all connected in various other books. So it really creates this entire community based on these characters, and it's just fantastic.
I'd like to go back to the Natalie Babbitt books, because the one, if people are familiar at all with them, the book they're familiar with because it was made into a film is Tuck Everlasting. And Tuck Everlasting is another one of those books that kids read differently than adults do. It's a book that talks in very, very clear, very realistic terms of what life would be like if there were no death. So Tuck Everlasting, I think, is just a fascinating, fascinating book to read. But an even better book by her, which does not get as much play, I think, is The Wreck of the Amaryllis, which is about love that lasts past death.
Wow. So this is fixation for her as a writer.
Yes. Yeah.
Notion
oh, yeah.
of death and,
yes.
and beyond death.
Right. And in both of those, there is a little bit of fantasy. But it's not magic realism. I mean, it's not, for me, it's what I call elastic realism.
Huh. Thanks for that recommendation, Tara. Mimi says, when my son was 13 or 14, he introduced this book to our family. We all found it very memorable. The Book Thief by Marcus Zusak.
Yes.
Hard to say that last
yeah.
name, which is a book that my mother, who was a bookseller, brought to our house as well. So,
yes. I mean, you know, there's just so many. I mean, we talk, you know, oh, there's so many books, so little time. But in fact, there are so many wonderful, wonderful books out there. And we sometimes, because we're creatures of an advertising age, we tend not to look beyond what's perhaps listed on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or what's on the front table at Barnes & Noble. Instead of talking to librarians, talking to booksellers about their books, or being on a program like this where, you know, I always come away with so many books I want to go back and read. I want to go, you know, get Captain's Courageous now and take a look at that again.
Well, here are a couple that Penelope sends in. Mildred Taylor's Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, a realistic look at the conflict of being an African-American girl in Jim Crow era 40s. Lois Lowry's Number the Stars and The Giver, mm-hmm. also both really great books.
And two more to follow that.
Really?
Yes.
In total contrast, any of the wonderfully illustrated and thoughtfully written books by Patricia Polacco also look carefully into the kinds of interactions adults and children can have that transcend merely telling a story.
Yes.
And talk about relationships.
Yes. Yeah, Patricia Polacco is another author to really get to know, because her books are the kind of books that you absolutely treasure.
There are a zillion emails here. I think I'm going to go quickly back to the phones really quickly. Tony in Woodinville.
Hi. Are you familiar with Chris Crutcher?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's your recommendation.
Anything he's written that I've gotten my hands on have been really, really good. They deal with some pretty mature subjects for kids, but he used to work for CPS in Spokane.
Oh, okay.
And he tackles a lot of hard subjects, but he does it well with humor and with real feeling. And he's one of my favorite young adult authors.
Well, great. Thanks for recommending him.
And I think his memoir is called King of the Mild Frontier. I'm not mistaken, although that could be somebody else.
That's an excellent name for a book.
Great name.
Thanks for that. I'm trying to get through some of these emails. Peggy says, I've enjoyed the Flavia Deluce series by Alan Bradley.
Right. I think older teens, 16, 17, who like, don't like a lot of excitement, but like a really a very nice main character will like the Flavia Deluce.
I don't know.
The Flavia Deluce mysteries by Alan Bradley, now up to, I think, number 5.
Susan says, some books my 12-year-old daughter and I have both enjoyed. The Emily of New Moon series by L.M. Montgomery. The prose is breathtaking. Also, the Looking Glass Wars series by Frank Bedore. Ice Mark Chronicles by Stuart Hill. You know, there's one theme that I read, which is a lot of these books are series. And I guess, for one thing, when I was younger maybe than a teenager, but going through teenagerdom, and still to this day, I like being put into somebody's world, and I like the fact that I can right. stay in that world, which
right.
is what I liked about Harry Potter and why I cried at the end of the last book, because the world, it was over.
Right. Yes, and I think that's with the Narnia books,
yes.
you know, and then there's that awful part where Susan is denied entrance into the Narnia series. But I don't think that feeling goes away when we grow up. I think that's the great success of series books. Mm. I mean, we want to read the next Elizabeth George because we want to find out what...
But we're mad at her for killing characters. So if you haven't read any Elizabeth George, just stop that. Yes, it's true, though, because you get attached.
You get attached to the characters. And even though it's the plot that keeps you reading, I would argue, it's that you want to spend time with these characters that you've grown to care about. And that's what makes it so horrifying when somebody that we've really grown to care about dies. But then I would say that's life. That's what happens in the real world. People die at the end.
Oh, the world of books. I'm so sorry we couldn't get to all of your emails. Nancy Pearl is with us every month. She's the author of Book Lust, More Book Lust, Book Crush, Book Lust to Go. You hear her regularly here on KUOW and on NPR. She hosts the Seattle Channel show Book Lust with Nancy Pearl. 2004, I'm reading this. She won the National Book Association Award. And my very favorite thing to do with Nancy, maybe we'll do it sometime, is when we get to match your tastes with a book that you might not have heard of.
Wonderful
topic. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. Danielle Anthony Goodwin is our intern. We're going to talk about technology tomorrow with Gavin Newsom. Hope you can join us on 94.9 KUOW.
You can find lots more book recommendations from Nancy Pearl at our website, KUOW.org. And speaking of literature, last week, KUOW's Ross Reynolds talked with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Paul Muldoon about poetry and rock lyrics. One song in particular Muldoon talked about was Bruce Springsteen's song, The River. So if you like pondering the intersection of poetry and lyrics, you can listen back to that interview at our website. Just search for Muldoon. It's 10:59. Alaska's Iditarod dog sled race is in its second day. We'll find out what's happening in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
KUOW and the University of Washington present the Graduate School's Public Lecture Series featuring Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute Professor Ron Eaglash on March 6th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.